Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, the cast and director of the new film, Guest of Honor, Lysla de Oliveira, Atom Egoyan, and David Thewlis. That's all coming up on Endeavors. Indecision. Many years ago, when my parents decided to renovate my childhood home, and that was everything from taking out the extra chimney to ripping up the floors, we met a lovely lady who became our interior designer. This was back in 1999, 2000, I want to say. I remember having my 12th birthday party meet on the front lawn of our house because we had no floor space. That lady has stayed friends with us for the last 20 years. And her name is Shushan. Her son, who I've met casually over the years, happens to be a well-known, an even Oscar-nominated Canadian filmmaker. And ever since, well, first since I started getting into filmmaking and then podcasting, I've always wanted to have this person on my show. Fortunately, this past week in Toronto was the Toronto International Film Festival, or TIFF, and he has a new film premiering at TIFF called Guest of Honor. It stars our David Thewlis, Lysla de Oliveira, Luke Wilson, and Rossif Sutherland. So, I finally got to interview Atom Egoyan along with David Thewlis and Lysla de Oliveira. What you're going to hear today, though, is something a little bit different in just in terms of how the interviews went. After initially requesting an interview with Atom, I ended up getting all three. Lysla by herself, and then Atom and David together. But the interviews were done in a round table format. So I was with three other reporters, bloggers, podcasters, and we all sat around and we went in turn. So with Lysla, there's a lot of questions. I think I only asked about four of them. With Atom and David, it is two. So I will not be the only voice you hear, other than obviously my guests, during this episode. So as I mentioned, we had Lysla de Oliveira on her own, and then Atom and David afterwards. So the first interview here is with Lysla Oliveira, who has appeared in such TV series as COVID Affairs, Nikita, and Gothica, as well as The Gifted, and more recently, Locke and Key. She plays Veronica in Atom's new movie, Guest of Honors, and has seven films in various stages of post, including In the Tall Grass, Business Ethics, Code 8, and Needle in a Haystack. So here is the round table interview with Lysla de Oliveira.
Thanks for having me, and maybe down the road we can have a more extended conversation. So the guilt and the shame in Adam's films, I've been a fan and been following for many years. Clearly a huge part of your character. No light questions here, by the way, so I apologize.
Exciting.
We're going right here.
An Adam McGuinn film, so I know.
There you go.
No light.
And I just came from an interview and a Hidden Life, Terrence Malick. So, yeah, the guilt and the shame, where do you draw from for that? I mean, aren't we all sort of just bundles of guilt, shame, and paradox? And here's this young woman who wants to stay in jail.
Yeah. I think that's just being human. We all carry guilt and shame, and you know that affects our relationship with ourselves, our relationship with each other, how we see the world, how we carry ourselves. And so I feel like any actor, I try to, you know, take from my own experiences or imagine what it would be like. But the great thing about working with Atom is that we did have the time to explore that and to, you know, share with each other, and also improvise scenes that weren't in the film. And he would ask me a lot of questions as Veronica, so I was able to create that and go in there. And so when we shot, we were very much ready to go, all oiled up and ready to, you know, dive in deep.
So Mike from CKC.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering, how did Adam McGuinn like coach you? How did he prep you for this role?
So I did an audition, and then I heard back from, I think it was a month or 2 months later. I was in town shooting something else, and so he was courting me, and I didn't know. It was funny because I always say it was a lot like dating. I was like, are you seeing anybody else? Because I'm hoping this is exclusive. And then I found out that it was, which was amazing. But he is so great. He's so available. He would cut out articles for me to read or send links, and I would do the same. And because I, you know, of course, all of this is so new to me, but he just made it such a safe space. So if an idea, you know, if I had an idea in the middle of the night, I could shoot him a text or an email, and, you know, we would riff off of that. And because there were so many conversations about the character, you really feel like it's like you've studied for the exam, you know, like, and when you're on set, it's game time, and you're ready to go. And he's so present on set. He doesn't watch the monitor, he watches you, which can be a little bit intimidating. That's cool. But I actually kind of liked it, and I then understood why his movies have this, like, air to them. It's like, oh, it's because he's standing there. Hmm. And also, he actually starts to direct. Like, if you're shooting, let's say I had a scene with Rossif, and it was Rossif's coverage, when we turned around, he was already giving me notes from just hearing my voice from, you know. So I thought that was cool, too, because I'd never had that before. He just plays a lot of attention. You know, it's his baby, so.
Yeah, very cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dan from Devil's Radio.
Thanks.
Yeah, you know, given the nature of Adam's films and how they sort of move back and forth through time, I'm curious, was it one of those films where you received the whole script right at the beginning, or did you, or was it more like you received bits and pieces?
That's funny you say that, because obviously David did, but I didn't. Adam did not know who I was. No, so I had to base it off of my own instincts until I did get the script. And when I did, there were many versions of it, and you know, I was just so, because when he met me, he was so open to hearing my opinions and my thoughts, and I was like, what does Adam McGuinn want to, like, you know, it wasn't just him pushing on his ideas, he was actually genuinely curious about how I felt about the script, which was really nice. Yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely.
Steve from Screen Fish.
You do a wonderful job.
Thank
you. Really do. And certainly, I mean, this is a film, I want to stay away from spoilers because there's all sorts of things in there. But, I mean, your character is in prison, not just physically, but also emotionally.
That's a great way to put it, for sure.
I was wondering what you think it would take for her to be truly free.
Wow, that's such a deep question. I don't know
or can she be?
If she can be.
Yeah.
I think even, you know, I've talked about this to Adam before. I think even if she had known the things that she ended up, you know, ends up finding out about her family or her father, even if she knew that in the beginning, I think she would still end up in the same place, because it's really about relationship with self.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think there's a little bit of freedom there towards the end, but I don't know if she can, you know, she carries a lot of guilt and darkness and heaviness because of the experiences she's had so early on in her life.
Yeah.
And we're all traumatized in some way by family and by the experiences we live, especially at a young age. Mm. It's hard to kind of get rid of those traumas.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So trauma, abuse, again, pretty deep and dark film, but I think ultimately, though, I think kind of hopeful, too, in a lot of respects, which, I mean, maybe even through the music, you as a band leader, you know, you're creating, you're this artist.
Through one avenue to let go.
Well, to heal.
Yeah.
But also to connect with the audience and with others and so on. How do you, as a person, as an actor, as a human being, or how does Veronica, or how could we actually, do you think, protect ourselves from that?
From that?
Yeah, from that kind of, you know.
You know, it's funny because I think that's the... Go to therapy.
Yes, good call.
I think in some way, like, that's why we're on Earth, is to have those experiences and to learn how to deal with them and how to be comfortable with yourself, because it is all perspective in a way. Yeah, and therapy really helps. I'm a big advocate for therapy, clearly, but... Yeah.
What about community and others?
And community, but, you know, in Veronica's case, it's tough because she is such an introvert. And so I don't think, you know, there is that idea of, oh, well, why didn't she just, you know, go to a friend or ask for help or tell her? She's not that type of person. She's not a shoulder. She's not somebody who could be there for somebody. So I don't think she thinks somebody could be there for her. And so if you are more of an introvert, I think community is a little bit tougher, but it is great to find love in people if you can. I think it's a healthy way to go.
So besides this movie, of course, what's your favorite Adam McCoy movie?
It's so funny because I had seen some of his movies, but he didn't want me to watch any.
Oh.
Yeah, because he wanted to create a character that was very different from anything he had done before.
Hmm.
And then I watched Exotica, and he called when I was watching. I was like, I'm watching Exotica. He's like, oh, God, don't watch any more of my movies. He's so funny. He's just a jokester.
Yeah.
I really liked Exotica, actually. I think it explored, you know, a lot of... explored similar themes. And I'm actually a really big fan of Chloe. I really like that one as well. So.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
A lot of your scenes in the movie were with just one other person, whether it was Luke or Rossif or David. And that creates a certain type of, I think, intimacy between the characters. How did you find that working relationship when you were shooting in terms of being able to push yourself further than maybe if it was, you know, four or five actors in one scene?
Yeah, I think I was so lucky because each actor was so open and so generous, so felt comfortable to go there, and they're amazing actors, and I also really admire all of them. So for me, it was like, oh no, I have to, this is my chance to, you know, show what I can do. So I think that definitely helped, you know, push me, and also Adam is standing right there, so so I definitely went for it. I just felt like, wow, when am I going to get this opportunity again? I don't know, so I might as well, you know, give it all I got.
She's such a complex character in a lot of ways, and I mean, maybe this is an impossible question, I don't know, but I was wondering, if you had the chance to visit her in prison, what would you say?
Wow, I haven't gotten that one before. That's a good one. What would I say? I don't know if she would listen to me. Because she's so in her own, you know, stuff. But I would ask her... I would be curious to know what... I know how she feels, but I would want her to say out loud how she feels about herself.
Mm.
And put that up there. Because I think that's the main thing. I think, and going back to therapy, when you say these things out loud, it does help. And I don't think she's ever said anything out loud. She doesn't have, you know, those friendships. And so there's just so much power being given to all these things that are unsaid and she lives with.
Thank you.
Yeah, there's something about speaking the truth, right? I think.
And taking the power away from something.
So two questions, one fun, what, and one a little deeper. Do you have a rabbit's foot? And and is it on you right now? And then the other question is, one of the themes that's developed for me, I'm about 15 interviews in, believe it or not.
Are you?
Yeah, pretty deep interviews too.
Gosh.
And one of the themes that's been developing is that people are, actors and actresses are taking away from the film after. And one of the directors I interviewed said, you know what, David, I don't know what my film's about yet until the audience actually sees it.
Hmm.
And I thought that was really brilliant in that even this conversation here today, this roundtable, first one for me, there's a dynamic, we're getting to know you a little bit and so on. So I'm just wondering, how does Guest of Honor, do you think, how has it already resonated with you, I suppose? And do you think, I mean, Adam's films are kind of like that.
Well, I think the great thing about, I mean, when you read the script, it took me a couple of reads to sort of understand and grasp everything that was happening. But it's so great when you watch it because it does make sense. And I think that's the beauty of Adam's movies. It's like you sit there and you take it in. And I'm actually able to watch it without, after the first watch where I hate watching myself. But when I watch it again, watching it as a character and take it in and seeing like, oh, wow, she's feeling this and this moment, which you're not really thinking or aware that you are thinking on the day. So I'm actually really excited to watch it again tonight because I feel like every time I watch it, I learn something new and I take something in and I'm able to watch it as a film versus just watch me on a big thing.
So I have a different kind of question. We're here at TIFF and the energy is crazy. And you're in this cool movie, and doors are opening. You get to go to cool spots. I was wondering if you had any fun anecdotal experiences.
I did.
Yeah.
Two days ago or something, I went to a Variety Chanel dinner, and I got to wear Chanel head to toe, and it was a total Cinderella moment. They picked it up the next day at 10 a.m., and I did get to eat beside some people I really admire.
You got a name
like
drop.
Kerry Washington, okay. Wow. Who was so lovely to me. You name it, they were there, like Nicole Kidman, and Allison Janney. Well, I didn't eat, we were all just in the same room, but
a little disappointed I didn't get an invite.
I know, you weren't there.
Come on.
I don't even know why I got an invite, to be honest with you. And I was kind of standing there like, what am I doing here? And I think that Carrie saw that, and she was so lovely to me. I'm working on a series that comes out next year called Lock and Key, and I work with Darby, who she worked with on Scandal. And so then I brought Darby up, and she was so lovely. And she's like, let's take a selfie to send to Darby. And I was like, oh, my gosh. But more than that, I just admire all these people, and it's just, I'm just still taking it all in. I don't know why I was at that dinner, to be honest.
No,
I'm glad I was there, though.
You're wonderful.
I was there. I just dressed as a waiter.
Oh, okay. No, that was it. You.
That was me. I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah. I messed up your order. I'm sorry.
And then we all went to this party. It was very, very, very fabulous.
I actually talked to Cardi B at the club.
Oh, my gosh.
That was my big moment.
Can I just say something
that
David, I don't forget what quote, but when I first met him, he quoted Cardi B, and I was just like, this is a man. Like, this is a man. I'm excited to work with him.
So. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just curious, Case, when I watched the film, I sort of had to let it sink in like I do with all of Adam's films. And you mentioned you read the script a few times. When did you first realize, towards the end, what actually went on with your character? Like, what sort of put it all together, the different pieces?
I think from very early on, because we discussed so much, but I think also as I was shooting, I was finding things. And I think still, like you said, like still discovering and still finding things. It's a very complex character. So I couldn't tell you. Maybe in a month or something, next year.
Okay. just thinking about her motivations and her feelings, like she's such, there's so much going on within her. It's just wonderful. does an experience like this, performing and creating, helping create a character like this, does it affect you personally when the cameras stop rolling? Like, yes. does it change you?
It's very heavy, and it's hard. It's really hard to shake it off. I was lucky because, like I said, I had been shooting something else in town, and that was my first experience. It hasn't come out yet, but that was my first experience being on set every day, and it was a Stephen King film, so exploring just very heavy themes, if you will. So when I showed up to do Guest of Honor, I knew that it would be heavy, and it's tough. I mean, like, you get to your hotel room at the end of the day, and you're just like, it's so heavy. That's why I was really glad we shot in Hamilton, because I was able to isolate myself and really just dive in deep, because there weren't a lot of us, too, so that's what we were exploring throughout the day. And I don't know, I'm still trying to learn how to shake it off at the end of the day. It's quite difficult, but it's also quite rewarding to know that you are able to access those feelings. Like, so there's a bit of like, oh, I don't want to feel this, but yay, I'm you know, doing the thing, and I hopefully somebody can relate or feel something. You know, that's why I act, is to make other people feel things.
So it sounds like you're sort of already starting to answer the question that I had. Walter says something to you. I want to haunt you. I'm assuming, and clearly, you know,
he does.
Well, he does.
Yeah.
There's a lot of haunted folk in this film. And I maybe that's the question I need to ask Adam as well. What's been perpetually haunting him all these years? Because there's these themes, right?
You should haunt him.
I will.
You should haunt him.
Yeah, maybe I should haunt him. So it's a question, but it's really more of just a comment. I mean, you know, we're all, and this is what I find so brilliant about film, is it takes us places if we allow the space for it, and allow us to have this conversation, right? Like, it's the beauty of it and the freedom of it as well. I don't know if any of that makes any sense.
So what's the question?
I don't even know if there is one.
I agree.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do. I think I do. I know what you're saying. In terms of, like, what haunts you in your life, or just... Yeah, I think I understand what you're saying.
Well, there's just this sort of space that I think Adam's been working in for many years.
Yeah.
Trauma, abuse, etc.
I love that. I think that's what's so special about him. He really explores themes of isolation, I would say. And there's a poet, her name is Rupi Kaur. I don't know if I'm pronouncing her last name, Kaur. I actually got to meet her at the party.
She's
it was really
amazing.
Exciting. She's the one person that I went up to and was like, can I have a picture? I love you. And one of her poems, I'm paraphrasing, but it says the you know, thing about being lonely is that we all feel it together.
Oh, nice.
And that's so great. That's Adam's movies in a nutshell, I think.
So Adam, working with Adam, Adam was a big accomplishment. Mm-hmm. Which big director would you love to work with next?
Tarantino.
Yeah, okay.
That would be amazing, I think.
You could be with Kerry Washington in the Django.
Yeah,
scene.
Me and Kerry Washington.
Yeah.
I would love that. Oh my god, now she's going to think I'm like a creepy upset.
I was just curious what your favorite memory or moment from shooting was.
Oh my gosh, there's so many. I think it was honestly before shooting, like getting on a plane, just being up in the air, like looking at the clouds and just being like, wow, I'm about to do this and it's really special. Yeah, I'm gonna cry. I'm really excited. It's all very new for me, so
You know, you've talked before about, or you've talked here about the fact that Adam gave you lots of notes and whatnot. I was wondering, how has working with Adam shaped you as an actor moving forward?
Oh, I learned so much. I feel like it's, and you know, my agents have kind of said, no, you're going to go to acting, like university all over again. Just because he really takes the time and he sees right through you. You know, he said, I don't know if I'd mentioned this before, but he was like, Veronica's very comfortable in stillness. And I said, I know. And he said, you're not. It's like, he just called me out. And of course then I want to rise to the occasion, and he's always calling me out, but in a very, like, I love, like, a very loving way. And I think that's, you know, what's so special about him is he really sees right through people, and probably why he's able to develop such complex characters in his films.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, guys.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
We're going to get you to wait here for David and Adam.
That was Elisla de Oliveira, who stars as Veronica in Atamagoyan's new film, Guest of Honor. The other star of Guest of Honor is the great actor David Thewlis. After his making his screen debut in Road and appearing in a small role in Little Dorrit, he first gained the world's attention in Naked, where he played a rambling drifter. His other films have included Black Beauty, Dragonheart, The Island of Dr. Moreau, James and the Giant Peach, where he was the voice of the Earthworm, 7 Years in Tibet, in which he co-starred opposite Brad Pitt and is now banned from China as a result, the incredible cult classic, The Big Lebowski, and of course, as Remus Lupin in the Harry Potter films, as well as The New World, Basic Instinct 2, The Boy in the Striped Pajamas, Anonymous, War Horse, Red 2, The Theory of Everything, Macbeth, Anomalisa, Wonder Woman, The Justice League, Rare Beasts, and the upcoming Avatar 2 and Avatar 3. In Guest of Honor, he stars as Jim, the father of Veronica, a lonely health inspector, perhaps struggling with morality. The director of the film is, of course, Atamagoyan. And few names in Canadian cinema bring such reverence as Atom. Not only has he directed film, but he's directed for stage and even worked on opera. He made his career breakthrough with the 1994 film Exotica and received an Academy Award nomination for his film The Sweet Hereafter. He's also directed Next of Kin, Speaking Parts, Felicia's Journey, Ararat, Where the Truth Lies, Adoration, Chloe, Devil's Knot, The Captive, and Remember. Atom and David sat down together in the next segment of our roundtable interview. Here is David Thewlis and Atamagoyan.
As the writer and as the deliverer, is that a word? Just the deliverer of the line. Just four quick chops with a cleaver, and then I'll never bother you again, I believe was the line. So one of my favorite lines now of all time. So as the writer, as the actor, tell me about the chop. Tell me about the symbol, the metaphor of that, the cutting off of the feet, and the fact that you're a man who's made some pretty interesting choices, it seems to me.
You're looking, do you want to say that one?
It's a biggie.
I think, the film, there's some odd clues into David's character, Jim Davis. I think at this speech that he makes, at one point he actually makes a toast and he says his blood, which is sort of this notion of it's a sacrament. And I think there is this, he's elapsed something, right? And I think that there's this decision. I think by the time he actually brings that rabbit in, he knows that he's ill and he knows that he's not long on the planet, and he wants to create these sacraments, and he wants to create his own, and the rabbit feet sort of become this thing as we gather that he wants to be in the casket with him, and he wants to be holding them almost in this kind of bodily pharaonic, like a pharaoh-like way, and so there's this thing he's moving towards. And there's something he can't do, which is, he can't cut the feet. He can prepare it. And again, that you can imagine that he says, I wash the feet and I dry them like this. And it's all, there's this sense of a sacrament, but that he needs to actually have it performed by this other place. It's as though it's a ritual that he's created on the spot. And having done an inspection there, and actually having had this moment of revelation, personal revelation there, that site of the kitchen becomes very important to him. Now, it's interesting saying all this because I don't think we went over this in detail at all. But as I watch the film, it feels like that's what's happened. And I don't know for the life of me if we talked about it, it would have been, it could be any more touching and moving than what David has done intuitively. And actually this process of this film, it's been odd having these conversations because you realize that actors, I think, just intuit things. I think that's what I feel, and I'm inspired to say these things because of what David, how he performs it.
So Adam, I was wondering, to get your comment on the state of Canadian cinema. We're here at TIFF, we've got two Canadian Midnight Madness movies,
yeah,
and then this one. So can you give like the state of the union for Canadian cinema right now?
Well, I think it's a really exciting moment because we're seeing a whole generation of younger filmmakers, and I've seen some of those films, and they're really exciting talents. And I think we're understanding that what diversity really means, and the festival is able to embrace that. So it's an exciting moment, you know, and the filmmakers, you know, using these new technologies are able to tell these stories in a very professional way with budgets that are actually not dissimilar from what I had with my first features. You know, that's interesting that 30 years later, actually what we spent most of our money on 30 years ago was film stock, you know, and processing and developing. So it's interesting that you can still have those budgets and make films of such high quality. So it's a good time. It's a wonderful time, and I look forward to catching up on a lot of the films here that I haven't seen, and you all have, obviously.
That's encouraging.
Yeah.
Great.
I think given the trajectory of your careers, I found this was a very good marriage, creatively, and I'm just curious, in terms of working with each other, was it mutual interest? Who, Adam, did you direct to David? David, did you want to work with Adam?
I presented David with this script, and I just crossed my fingers and hoped he would respond, and he did. And I think I would have there's a generation of actors that I think would have known my work or would have heard of me, and that certainly was the case. What's interesting is that when you work with someone like Liza, she hasn't seen any of my films before, and so I told her not to, right? I think she'd seen Chloe perhaps, but you know, that moment when you're waiting for an actor to respond, and when you're dreaming and praying that they'll respond positively, it's just so wonderful when they do and you can meet them.
Well, it's funny you're saying that about it being sent to me and you waiting to hear, because from my end of things, as I remember it happens, my agent says, "Listen, I'm sending you through a script from Adam McGoyan," and my ears immediately prick up, going, "Oh, that sounds," after a bunch of things have been coming through, going, "Oh, this sounds," you know, and these days scripts arrive on your iPad, you know, you don't have to wait for it to arrive in the post or pick it up at your agency. So it came through in the next 10 minutes, and I was able to read it immediately, and because it was Adam, if it was someone else, I may have gone like, "Oh, I'll do that tonight or tomorrow or next week," if it's, you know, sometimes I've got things on my iPad now I've not looked at all for months. So I read it immediately within 10 minutes of hearing about it, and I'd say about 20 pages in, I was hooked and thought, "I think I'm going to do this." I remember saying to my wife, going, when I read the line where Veronica says, "Because I want to be here, Dad," and that intrigued me enough to think, like, this is definitely something that's going to... Firstly, I'm definitely going to sit here and finish it now. I'm not going to go, "Oh, that's great, I'll look at that later, I'm going to finish it now." And I think I rang my agent straight away and said, you know, "I'd love to see Atom as you were flying in through from Europe." So it's actually very short, my involvement in the decision to make it. And I must stress, mainly based on my familiarity with Atom's work, certainly since, you say, the trajectory of our careers going back to the 90s and being familiar with each other's work over that time. A name comes up and you think, "I know that's definitely wonderful quality." And then meeting Atom himself, and I think we had a great first meeting and got on wonderfully. And it was, you know, inevitable since then.
Jim is such a great character. But one of the things I think is so interesting about him, I mean, he sort of walks this line between justice and grace. You know, here he is, the guy with the power that he wields to shut down a restaurant because somebody sneezed in the salad, which isn't in the film, I understand. But I'm just saying, you know, that sort of power. And at the same time, he's fighting for his daughter. For both of you, but I mean, thinking of David first, you know, how did you find that balance when you were creating this character? Did you work together? Did you sort of bring notes? How does that develop?
I think, like Atom says, very sort of instinctively, I feel like that as an actor, I don't always like to over talk things with anyone. Sometimes that happens in theatre, like you spend a lot of time sitting around discussing exactly how a character should be played, and I'm always very much like, we just start doing it and start reading it or start performing it and then address the issues, because I've already arrived with an idea of how I think I might do it, and then lay it in front of you because you might have an entirely different idea before sitting down and discussing it at length. I think those discussions come once you've started to play it, and we didn't also have a lot of time to rehearse. I arrived in Toronto, I was coming from something else, and only had 2 days to work with Leisler, and those are the scenes we did first, the prison scene, so they were wonderful things. I think it would have been a little harder if we'd gone straight to some of the montage-y stuff of the restaurants and everything, because I thought, well, I don't know exactly who I'm playing yet, but since we got into the real meat of it by doing the prison scenes with Leisler, I came to understand early on what I was required to do for the rest of the film. So it's, you know, I tend not to intellectualize thinking of parts. I find it actually a nuisance to talk about it too much and say he is like this, he is like this. The only time I've done that is with Mike Lee, but there it's necessary because you're creating the character from zero, where you talk an enormous amount of building a character. But once, you know, a writer, director has gone through the writing and creating the character already on the page, a lot of the work is already done. And then it's like, well, what do you think of this? And then we talk. I mean, then we talk constantly through the making of the film, in between setups and takes and dinners, and, you know, constantly analyze it there. But I don't think we talked initially that much about what this should
be. It's just fascinating, the whole process of doing these discussions, like, before the premiere, because there's lots of things that, like you were saying, like you see it in the film, you see it in the performance, and it must have been there intuitively, but it wasn't discussed that way specifically. And that's the mysterious part about the process. Like, it's mysterious that and it's just the nature of a good collaboration that things are transmitted, and that it feels it gets richer as you get other people's response, and you have to, it's a funny thing, you know, when you talk about rehearsals too. The rehearsals actually do begin with those first meetings, like when we first meet on the script. You know, like in that meeting, it builds through this process where, yes, we didn't have a lot of rehearsal time, but we had discussions and we had ongoing sort of conversations, and that just enriches the character. And I think an actor like David sees that I'm getting excited about something that he's delivering, and because I'm so close to his performance, I'm literally like just right beside the camera. I think there's this transmission, and things that I find like are appealing to me, I don't have to say them. It's just, I think, because we're just connected to that point, it's sort of there's this flow, and it's very exciting when that happens. And so that, or you can just go up and just say one word, or you can just say one specific thing, like in the monologue, one person that you might be looking at differently, and focusing your attention on that person, and that there might be this feeling. It's interesting now, because of the way things work digitally, we tend to run the camera, that a lot of the takes actually have the directions on them as well. Because I was reviewing some of the stuff, and it's just interesting what I'm saying and how you immediately seize on it. And there isn't that much spoken about, but we're just in that zone. And that's what's so exciting about this process and the camera. Because I'm working with the collaborators who are really close to me, I've been working with them for a long time, I don't have to be speaking to them about things. And like Paul, because he's operating the camera, he's able to kind of follow the action in a certain way. I don't have to tell him, because I just know that he's doing that. So it's great. It's kind of a rare thing. And then you get an actor like David, and you're bringing him into this very, you know, artisanal, rarefied space, and there's no other interference. There's no other people who are looking at a monitor, calling me over, you know, and saying, you know, can you get him to do this? It's just us, right? And so it's a privilege. I'm very thankful to be in that place, but it's very intuitive when it gets to that moment.
There's something, I mean, Adam, they're profoundly existential about all of your films and your themes, and you brought up Mike Lee, David, and your performance of Johnny Fletcher, the apartment like rant,
Johnny Slack.
Sorry.
No, I don't think someone mentioned in the film his name.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I just know he was called that. So I know everything.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right,
yeah. Fletcher. That's interesting. What does that say about you? I believe they used to make arrows, the Fletchers.
Well, in Canada, Fletcher is it's sort of an iconic mythological figure associated with independent film of the 90s. A Fletcher character is like, no.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So whatever his name was, and I
won't do anything about the name Fletcher. I know Fletcher is French for arrow, so the Fletcher.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
All right, a little comedy here.
I learned that. I learned that from the roadside.
So, but really, a pretty crazy, profound rant, existential rant. Yeah, yeah. You're, in this film, you're a man that follows rules, you know, the code, you've got the pass sign in your briefcase. I mean, it's everywhere that you're a man who's made some pretty, I think, crummy choices. Mm. I'm just wondering about how, I mean, I have no idea what I would do with your script if you said, hey,
that's interesting. What are the crummy choices?
I don't know. I'm wondering.
I just think he made this choice, which is like, I don't think he would tell his daughter that his ailing wife had given him permission to have an affair with her music teacher. Like he would not be able to explain it to her at the age of 10, and certainly after this traumatic thing that happens, and he doesn't know that his daughter might be partially responsible for what happened to the teacher. I mean, I just think that history in his mind is sealed off. And when he begins to understand that it actually wasn't so sealed off in his daughter's imagination, and that she did see certain things, yes, he does make the maybe seemingly crummy decision to say that did not happen, but it comes from a place where he's convinced that she couldn't have seen it, and he believes that myth, and he also believes that if he tells her why that happened, which is that his wife gave him permission, she just would not believe that. I mean, given who she is and the anger she feels, like that's way too convenient. So I do think that close-up of David at the end, where he's in the last inspection and he puts away, leaves his bag with the pass and veil, and he has this smile. I think he thinks, oh, well, maybe this priest, if I have my funeral at this, and I ask for this priest, maybe he'll transmit that history. I don't know if it's that clear in his mind, but I think he's in a trap. I think the crummy decision, crummy things have happened to him, but I don't know if those were decisions that he could have made otherwise. I suppose. Yeah, I just don't know.
I think we all make terrible decisions all the time. I mean, that's what.
Yeah.
I think it's really concerns me in life and in writing. I mean, my book, You Had to Kill Me, is all about a man making constant bad decisions time after time and not learning from it ever. It's one of the main themes of the book. So I don't think it's such a... I agree. I could, crummy or not, but certainly, you know, retrospectively bad decisions may be, but I don't think that's so unusual. And I think in the context of this, in terms of when to reveal a hidden truth from a childhood, or what to discuss with one's children, or to roll up some rabbit shit and pretend it's rat shit, is you know, bringing that his best idea. Yeah, actually, although that did achieve what he wanted to.
Yeah,
he got him the interview with the grandson, so it's a great idea.
Yeah.
So that's not a crummy idea. But that's one of the things to me that makes the whole character plausible, and there's nothing remarkable or fantastic about that. It's like going, that's just how we all live, and we make some bad decisions, and sometimes you think you made a bad decision, turns out to be a good one, and vice versa in life. So, you know, I think to me the story is very simple, and Jim isn't necessarily that complex. He's just like all of us, and that's how I saw him. And I didn't go, here I am playing a very, very complex character. I think here I am playing a regular guy, you know, because we're all complex, obviously. You more than most.
Can I quote you on that?
That's, well, please, please do. Yeah. Yeah. See, one earphone's on, one earphone's off.
That's awesome. Yeah. We're just scratching the surface here.
Yeah. I was interested in what you just said about being instinctive in your performances, and I can see, especially with like a role like this, you wouldn't want to brood on it too hard. But did you ever have a hard time? Are you kind of like a kind of guy when you're acting, you punch in, you punch out, or does it like come back with you like in weird ways when you're not working?
Always. You're always when you're mm-hmm. working. I'm doing something now in Quebec, and that's on the car here. I'm thinking that through. You're at work for the time you are there filming, but most of the time as an actor, you're constantly thinking about it, and you're often dreaming about it and waking up a few times. You know, once as the character, once as yourself, and then the character tends to wake up sometimes. When you're actually right in the middle of filming, I find it's never off your mind. That's not necessarily a bad thing or a disturbing thing. It's a conscientious thing, if anything.
Interesting.
I'm just curious, what do you think this film says about family and the relationship that we have with those who are closest to us?
What it says to me, again, it's familiar to me. I feel like Jim's familiar because he's like all of us, and it has resonances in my life, as I'm sure in all people's lives, really, in things that happen during childhood, some little crises, some little traumas in the family, or maybe misremembered and misaddressed and haven't taken the time to address them. I still don't think I talked to my father in the way that I think I will regret having not talked to him in the right way. He's 91 now, and he'll die one of these days, and I think I'll have regrets. And my mother died 8 years ago, and I learnt that those regrets exist after one's death. And I'm like, but why don't I therefore address them now with my dad? Because he's 91, and I still can, and he's still old, and he's still lucid. But I don't, because it would break the pattern of the behaviour we've had heretofore. You know, I choose not to. And I don't ring him as much as I could. I wish I could ring him now. But yeah, you know, we're all inconsistent and we all feel like we fail in that respect, I think.
I can't believe, I've never asked this to anyone before, but it's one of those things that, just listening to this conversation here, for both of you, you've made this film, you've made many films, but you've made this film, you've released it, you're showing it to the audience, and as you've both sort of said, oh, well, we haven't sort of looked at it from that way or that, I was wondering, What do you think about the relationship between the people creating the film and the audience? Because you hear these conversations like, well, I think it means this. Well, that's not how I intended it. But I was just wondering how you two feel about that.
Well, I do think that a film plays out in a viewer's imagination in a way that you cannot predict. And in a film especially like this, where there's so much space for interpretation, and it's almost designed to be subjective. I mean, it's a study in that, in a way, and so it's very enriching to get response and to see how people respond. And also, sometimes you're given these weird... Like, I remember with Sweet Hereafter, that I realized that one of the things that was being transmitted in the film was a narrative that I didn't intend. And when I heard it, I went, you can see the film that way. And it makes it way more accessible, even though it doesn't deal with scenes that were very important to why I made the film. But you can choose to actually block those scenes out and see this whole other narrative. And I was going, okay, that's interesting. It wasn't designed, but it's interesting you would be able to see the film that way. And I think that there are narratives in this film that I think are very important to me, but I don't think anyone's going to be necessarily thinking about them, like his decision I just explained, where, you know, he's asked to have this funeral at this particular church, which he seems to have no relationship to. And then there was a revelation that comes out about the priest knowing that history and giving it to the daughter. I mean, is that a person who's very manipulative, like, you know, kind of down to kind of manipulating shit so he can get conversations with the grandson, like, would he be thinking, could it be so manipulative that he would ask for a funeral and have this priest deliver a eulogy, thinking that the priest might give this history? I don't know if people are thinking about that, but it was certainly a part of like my understanding of what those scenes were about. Because there's nothing in the film that would make you think about that, because the question isn't raised by the characters. In the same way, like that, like big close up at the end where he smiles, it's not ever really explained what he might, why he might be smiling. Actually, we came up with a different thing. It was just a memory of her playing that piece on the piano. That's what I remember telling you. Mm. But now that I watch the film, I go, no, but it makes more sense that might be interpreted this way. But that's the beauty of this type of filmmaking, is that I just have the ability to kind of mold it and then leave it for the viewer to kind of construct by. With their own fantasy and their own kind of like their own emotions, and the film is porous enough to be that way, which is why it's also not everyone's cup of tea. I mean, you know, there are people who don't like watching a film that way, and I understand that, you know, and that's why, you know, I try and make these films, you know, in a way that they don't need to find a huge audience, because I know that you know, unless. I've been lucky sometimes when I'm working with sexual obsession, because I think that that's something that people kind of understand, irrational behavior or unexpected behavior when it's sexual obsession. But there is no sexual obsession in this film, thankfully. But I think that these are the zones of, not madness, but zones of behavior which are compelled by people wanting results in terms of how they should behave and being confused and challenged by choices, you know, and then an actor is then responding to that challenge of portraying that. So the viewer becomes super important. So we're super excited to play it, you know, in a couple of hours in this house and feel that's what that feels like. And for David, it'll be the first time he's actually seeing it with an audience. Yeah.
And congratulations. I don't think I said it, but yeah.
Lovely.
Thank you very much. Lovely.
Okay. Good to see you. That was writer and director Adam Egoyan and star David Thewlis talking about their new film, Guest of Honor. It had its world premiere at the Venice Film Festival on September 3rd and played here in Toronto at TIFF on September 10th. And I believe it is out in limited release now across Canada. Just want to apologize to Mr. Thewlis. Yes, I did wear my platform 9 3/4 socks to the interview. I am so sorry. That does it for the TIFF Roundtable of 2019. Hopefully I will have more in-depth TIFF coverage for you next year, but I hope you enjoyed the interviews with Laisla, Atom, and David. I'm super excited. My guest on Sunday's episode will be star of Murdoch Mysteries, Yannick Bisson. Thanks for tuning in, and I will see you next time. Bye for now.